live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, one of the hottest days of the year so far today and a heat advisory in effect through Wednesday night. We're chatting with Dr. Maria Rannan-Lay from Crystal Run Healthcare about how to stay cool and how to spot signs of heat illness. Toxic forever chemicals are still polluting New York's water, air, and land, costing billions in healthcare and cleanup. Coming up, we speak with Kate Donovan of NRDC about what the state legislature did and didn't do this session to address the PFAS crisis and why the burden on New Yorkers is only growing. James B. Huntington is here with local economic perspective, and guitarist Harvey Valdez brings Bach and Satie to life in unexpected ways at the Cragsmore Stone Church this weekend. Classical Kid is here, all after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Top members of President Trump's cabinet say the U.S. strikes this weekend on three Iranian nuclear targets were just that. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and others say the attacks were not intended for a change in Iran's regime. But writing online yesterday, President Trump said if Iran's leaders cannot make their country great again, quote, why would there not be a regime change? The events in Iran are hitting close to home in Los Angeles. That's where an estimated 500,000 people of Persian descent live. Steve Futterman reports.
This area of West L.A. is affectionately known as Tehrangeles, a combination of Tehran and Los Angeles. Reza H. welcomes the American involvement. He does not want to give his last name because he has family still living in Iran.
I'm so sorry for damage, but I'm happy for future.
He hopes the Ayatollah will be deposed. So does Ruzbeh Farahanipour, but he is against the American attack.
I don't have anything in common with the regime. I don't like them. I hate them, but this is not the right way to do that.
Many have mixed emotions, like Adi Barami.
I think most of us, we are happy, but we are also like a bit worried about what's going to happen afterwards.
They all say they've been trying to reach their loved ones in Iran, but it's very difficult to get through. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
President Trump is set to depart for the NATO summit in the Netherlands tomorrow. His trip abroad to meet with European allies comes after he ordered the strikes on Iranian sites. NPR's Deepa Shivaram has more.
The president will spend just over a day at The Hague meeting with European allies. The main focus of this year's summit is getting NATO nations to increase their defense spending to 5% of total GDP. It's a huge bump from the current mandate of 2% GDP spending on defense, but the ongoing war between Ukraine and Russia and Russia's threats of continued force have pushed European nations to try and reconfigure their own defense capabilities and rely less on the United States. President Trump has been critical of NATO for years, saying the U.S. spends too much money on supporting Europe. He said last week that NATO countries should increase to the 5% number, but he doesn't think the United States should have to. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
The U.S. Embassy in Qatar has issued a warning to Americans in that Middle Eastern country. The embassy says out of an abundance of caution, American citizens should shelter in place until further notice. The State Department is urging Americans around the world to use increased caution after the weekend bombings in Iran. Weather forecasters say it will be brutally hot today in large swaths of the central and eastern United States. The first major heat wave of this season is underway. Heat values and temperatures will exceed 100 degrees in several urban areas today, from Columbus, Ohio to Boston. There are heat cautions posted from eastern Texas up to New England. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Federal officials have released a new population estimate for eastern North Pacific gray whales. It's about 13,000, the lowest number since the 1970s. From member station KNKX, Bellamy Palethorpe has more.
Scientists were expecting the whales to rebound after the end of an unusual mortality event in 2023. These gray whales are known for their past resilience. They travel thousands of miles every year on an epic migration from the calving lagoons in Baja to the Alaskan Arctic, where they feed. But climate change has melted the ice there, making it harder for them to find food. Amy Lang is a research biologist with NOAA Fisheries in Seattle. She says some stranded gray whales appear emaciated.
There's been numerous observations of live whales that are migrating that are really thin.
Lack of food also appears to be affecting reproduction. The estimated calf count is 85. the lowest since records began in 1994. For NPR News, I'm Bellamy Palethorpe in Seattle.
Automaker Tesla says it has launched limited robo-taxi service in Austin, Texas. The company is led by billionaire Elon Musk. The cars are self-driving. Only certain guests are able to access the robo-taxi service, and it's limited to certain streets in Austin. Another company, Waymo, has been using self-driving vehicle taxis in California. The founder of package delivery company FedEx has died. Fred Smith was 80 years old. Smith is credited with revolutionizing the package delivery service. He started FedEx in 1971. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Well, dangerously hot and humid conditions continue today with feels like temperatures reaching over 100 degrees in several areas of the region. Right now, it's 83 at our Liberty Studios, but the real field temperature is 96. Extreme heat and humidity can be more than just uncomfortable. It can be life-threatening. Joining us now is Dr. Maria Rannan-Lay, a primary care provider at Crystal Run Healthcare, to talk about how this kind of weather affects our health, what symptoms to watch out for, and how to stay safe. Doctor, thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, hi, Kim. How are you? Good morning.
I'm hot. Thank you. First, just how dangerous are the kinds of conditions we're expecting this week? Temperatures in the 90s with heat index values over 100. What happens to the body under these conditions?
Yes, you know, Kim, it can be very dangerous depending on the population as well. The most vulnerable populations would be the children, the infants, the elderly, the ones that with chronic conditions such as congestive heart failure, asthma, COPD, the outside workers. So the symptoms that you should be looking out for is when you have excessive sweating, nausea, dizziness, headache, palpitations, or fast heartbeat. You just generally don't feel well because of the extreme heat. So you have to watch out for these things that's called heat exhaustion. Mm-hmm. That's a precursor for the more dangerous one called heat stroke. That's a medical emergency. That's when your core body temperature goes up to 104 degrees. And that is when you already have confusion, unconsciousness or passing out. The skin is very dry and hot, very rapid heartbeat. Now, that's a medical emergency. You have to call 911, or the family member should call 911 for you if that ever happens.
I mentioned in the introduction the temperature, but then also that feels like number, or the heat index. Why is that heat index number important for people to pay attention to?
Yes, the heat index is actually what it really feels like compared to the actual temperature. It's a combination of the actual temperature and humidity. So it really shows you how it really feels to the body. Like, say, for example, it's really just 90 degrees outside, but with humidity, it can feel above like 104, 105 degrees. So that makes it worse.
And how does that high humidity make the health risks even worse? Is it harder for the body to cool down?
Exactly. So if you have high humidity, so how your body cools down when it's really hot outside is you sweat, right? And that evaporation of the sweat is how your body cools down its temperature. So, however, if the humidity is really, really high, the sweat does not evaporate. So then that gets your body still high out in the temperature. It's still very high despite the heat. There's no way to cool down your body temperature. So that makes it even more dangerous.
The World Health Organization has warned that intense summer heat is becoming more frequent due to climate change. If extreme heat like this is the new normal, how should we be adapting?
That's a very good question. It really has become the norm, not the exception anymore. So we have to relearn our heat awareness. We have to treat the heat the way we treat snowstorms or hurricanes. It's a hazard. It can be fatal. So we have to understand things like heat index, which we talked about, the dew point, which is more important than the humidity. It's also how high the dew index is and the UV index. So we have to change our daily routines for that. One is you have to schedule your outdoor work or exercise during the early morning or early evening. You have to build rest breaks into hot weather activities, especially the outdoor workers. We have to change the way we wear, the clothes we wear. We have to wear loose, light-colored, breathable clothing. Our hydration habits, we should be very aware of. We have to drink water regularly. You don't have to wait until you're really thirsty. You have to make sure you have this at least 1 to 2 liters of water a day in a container so you have an understanding of how much you already drank during the day. And make sure you have electrolytes in it, right? You have electrolyte tablets such as Element or NUM and UUM, as long as you have electrolyte or hydration salts. You have to know where the cool spaces are, especially for our marginalized population where there's no air conditioning. You have to know where your community air conditioning centers are before the heat wave starts, right? Home modifications, make sure you have shades, curtains, reflective films or windows. The ceiling, the fans also help uncirculate air. You know, you have to, especially for the cities with the asbestos, concrete surfaces, the heat is even more pronounced. So we have to have energy-focused measures for that.
You mentioned air conditioning. It's a lifeline in this kind of heat, but not everybody has it. What are some other effective ways to cool down at home or stay safe without air conditioning?
So there are a lot of things that you can do. Some ice packs underneath the warm parts of your body, such as underneath the armpits. You know, the clothing should be very breathable. Avoid polyester because that doesn't breathe. Cotton is the one that breathes the best. And then make sure you have fans installed. And if in case of really severe heat waves, you have to know where your community air conditioned centers are, because every community should have one. We should be prepared for those heat waves, especially for this weather nowadays.
And we often hear and say that people should check on their neighbors or loved ones. What exactly should they be looking out for when checking on someone during a heat wave?
Thank you. Thank you for that question, because we do have our elderly populations. We also have our neighbors who live by themselves. So you have to watch out for nausea, headache, dizziness, confusion. Sometimes the neighbor knows you then one day and the next day doesn't know who you are. That's a sign of already heat stroke. That's a 911 call.
Finally, what's one piece of advice you wish more people would follow during a heat wave, but maybe often don't?
Oh, yes. We always forget to drink, right? A lot of my patients say, doctor, I drink a lot of water. Do you actually know how much you drink? You know, because that's very hard to measure if you don't have that actual thought in your mind all the time, right? Also, make sure that when you're walking outside, it's very hard to tell when you're already very hot. You have to remember that to keep in mind the temperature for the day. Every morning, I ask Alexa, Alexa, what's the temperature today? It changes every day. And I have to be prepared before I go out. What time is it the heated? Oh, Alexa.
I think she's going to answer you. I was just going to say, you probably have Alexa alerted a few of those around.
I totally just alerted mine. And then, so I have to be prepared myself. Right. So you have to remember, especially when you're outdoors, you have to be prepared mentally for the heat.
Mm-hmm. That's Dr. Maria Ranenle of Crystal Run Healthcare with some tips on how to stay safe and cool in the heat wave. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And a reminder, many counties, including Orange, Ulster, and Sullivan, maintain lists of cooling centers on their websites or through their offices of emergency services. And the United Way's 211 helpline, also a reliable resource for finding nearby shelters, health services, and transportation. We'll take a break, and when we come back, forever chemicals are everywhere in New York, and the costs keep climbing. Coming up, Kate Donovan of the NRDC explains the latest on PFAS legislation and its impact on everyday New Yorkers. This is Radio Chatskill.
It's Mimi. Public media is facing its most serious threat yet. The House voted to claw back $1 billion in public media funding, funds that were already approved by law. The Senate will take up the bill next. If they also vote yes, the impact on stations like Radio Catskill would be swift and severe. Don't let that happen. Urge your senators to vote against rescinding public media funding. Find out how at protectmypublicmedia.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we follow the network as it spreads beyond Brazil and it develops new tactics to get the word out for people to have safe abortions at a much larger scale.
I said, do we have to do this so public? You are nuts.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As New York's legislative session came to a close, the fight against PFAS contamination, or those toxic forever chemicals linked to serious health risks, is far from over. Despite early leadership in regulating the forever chemicals in drinking water and consumer products, the state continues to grapple with widespread pollution from over 1,200 industrial sites, contaminated landfills, firefighting foam, and everyday items. With federal standards delayed and the health and economic costs in New York estimated in the billions, advocates say the need for bold state action has never been more urgent. Kate Donovan, director of Northeast Environmental Health at the Natural Resources Defense Council, joins us now to break down what happened this session in Albany and where New York stands in the national fight against PFAS. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And let's begin with the 2025 legislative session in New York. What related bills moved forward this year in Albany and which ones failed to pass?
Well, the Senate was a real hero, right? All of our priorities, and I should back up saying that we ran a really strong campaign, a PFAS-free New York campaign, which addressed a number of bills from these toxic forever chemicals that appear in our consumer products, our personal care products that are in packaging, as well as that are being spread on farmland through sewage, sludge disposal. And the Senate passed all of these bills, which was great. We had a lot of momentum. And basically, they were left hanging in the assembly this year.
Why do you think the state has struggled to make more comprehensive action despite, you know, early leadership on setting, for instance, drinking water limits for PFAS? And is it a political, logistical? What is it, something else?
I think it's political at this point. This is interesting. I mean, as you mentioned in your intro, New York State had once been a leader on some of these chemical issues. You know, we were one of the first states to establish drinking water quality standards in New York. We have already banned the use of PFAS and other consumer products such as apparel, food, paper-based food packaging, firefighting foam. And consistently every year, the state had made an effort to kind of start chipping away at this problem. Now, it's been 2 years now where the state has failed to address some of these PFAS bills. I would say in the governor's budget, we did, or they did pass legislation to ban the use of PFAS in firefighting gear. That's kind of a no-brainer in a lot of ways. We'd done it in the foam, the gear, and the one bill that we did have, that did pass both houses in early in session would ban PFAS and toxic chemicals in menstrual products. So, I mean, the fact that we even have to have legislation banning the use of those chemicals and those types of products is beyond me. But honestly, those are two really small, you know, steps. And we had really substantial and, you know, and policy changing, broad policy and policy that would have addressed the use of chemicals in all sorts of these different products, as well as a bill that didn't pass, which was extremely important to understand and start to identify where all this PFAS is coming from all of those, as you mentioned, 1,200 different facilities across the state. That bill would have required the testing industrial producers to test their effluent to know where, so we know where these chemicals are coming from.
In New York has become sort of there's a big problem for PFAS contamination in the state. There aren't really major PFAS manufacturers, but can you walk us through the major pathways by which PFAS continue to enter the state's environment?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, right, so the big producers of PFAS chemicals are places like DuPont and Chemours and 3M, right? And those are in other states and they have big problems. But we have PFAS is used in all sorts of ways, in manufacturing, in industrial uses, and also in consumer products. So things like Teflon cookware, textiles, paint, ski wax, dental floss, right? All these daily consumer products that kind of you can find a product in every room in your home that would be using a PFAS chemical. And ultimately, a lot of the time, these products, I mean, most of the time, these products end up in our trash, right? Or down the drain, if you're talking about cleaning products or personal care products. So PFAS can enter, PFAS enters the drinking water system upstream. So if you're talking about a household, it comes down through your industrial, or sorry, your municipal kind of drainage. You might pour mopping wax or liquid down your drain or flushing it down the toilet, some type of other kind of products, or in the landfill. All of the consumer products that have PFAS go to our landfills. Those landfills eventually have a leachate, which is kind of the garbage juice, if you will, that they collect that is highly contaminated with PFAS chemicals, and they have to find a solution for that. Oftentimes it is discharged somewhere into surface water. So you have PFAS coming that way. You also have biosolids that are the residual sewage sludge, right, that is being sold to farmers as a fertilizer for their land, is often highly contaminated with PFAS. So we have PFAS entering into our food system through farmland, as well as that PFAS seeping into groundwaters and surface waters. And then you have the industrial sector. So all these different plants, like Saco Bay and Hoosick Falls, right? They're producing a product. Maybe they're using PFAS in the actual product, like coating Teflon pans. They're actually using it, or they're using it in their machinery to clean things. And these industrial facilities have emissions, air emissions, or water effluent that at this point in time are not required to filter out PFAS.
Your work recently is highlighting the financial toll of PFAS as well as the health risk. We often hear about the health risk, but that financial toll is pretty big. What are the current estimates for how much PFAS-related health care is costing New Yorkers, and who's paying for it?
Yeah, exactly. So our, you know, we did a really interesting analysis recently at NRDC, worked with our director of PFAS advocacy, Dr. Anna Reed, to really look at the social burden of PFAS. We did that analysis for California, and then we also worked on that analysis for New York. And what and how we did that work is we looked at some data that the Nordic Council of Ministries did on the kind of health costs of exposure to PFAS. Mind you, exposure to just two PFAS, right? And we know that it's a class of thousands. And they did an analysis on the various health impacts and the health costs. And we use that data to extrapolate for New York and California based on population and other factors. And we found that, you know, in healthcare costs, it's, you know, costing the state, you know, $2 to $4 billion annually. Now, these are really rough numbers, obviously. Monetizing healthcare costs, right, from exposure to toxic chemicals is inherently difficult. But using the data that was supplied by these Nordic countries, we feel like this is probably an underestimate too. And who's paying for it? We're all paying for it. Our insurance companies are paying for it, although they're becoming less interested in paying for our healthcare costs. And we're paying for it every day. In addition to that, we looked at the economic costs that PFAS are costing our state. We looked at what's already been spent in New York State to clean up PFAS. It's almost almost $500 million has already been spent in cleaning up PFAS contamination from the different water systems that have already been contaminated to military sites that have extensive contamination PFAS from firefighting foam, airports, with another estimated $1 billion in estimated projects to help municipalities filter out PFAS.
The EPA recently delayed implementing PFAS drinking water standards and may even repeal some. How does that move affect New York's ability or urgency to act independently? And is there a case now for New York adopting even stricter standards or being more aggressive?
Of course, and that's where a lot of our advocacy is focused on at the moment. Post-session is with the Department of Health. So New York State has MCLs at 10 parts per trillion for, you know, a few of these chemicals. The federal government, as you mentioned, last year had finally implemented drinking water standards for four parts per trillion, more protective of New York. As you mentioned, EPA has indicated they're going to be rolling back some of the standards for a number of other chemicals and delaying the implementation of the POFA and POFS standards. We worked with legislation at the end of session, which didn't pass either, which would have required the Department of Health in New York to adopt the more stringent federal standards. There's certainly going to be advocacy to force or to push, you know, Department of Health to adopt those more protective standards.
As you look ahead to 2026, I'm sure you've already started to look at that, even though 2025 is barely in the rearview mirror. What piece of legislative or regulatory action would you prioritize?
You know, we're going to really have to regroup as a community because we've been running this campaign for a couple years now with not a lot of success in the assembly. And we need to start understanding what is the roadblock. And as I said earlier, we do really feel that roadblock is political at this point in time. And of course, we know that chemical industry, the lobbyists are out there in Albany. It doesn't, you know, these bills pass almost unanimously in the Senate. They have oftentimes unanimous support when they go through committees on both sides. You know, this shouldn't be a political issue. Of course, affordability in New York is always a problem. And so that issue gets tacked on to a lot of these health protective measures. I think it's misguided. We know that if we have safer products, have less contaminants in our drinking water, we're going to save on healthcare costs, right? But that doesn't get factored into the discussion. That is a concern, and we'll be fighting for the same bills again. We're not going away, but we certainly need to address politically what's happening in our state assembly of not passing these bills.
And if you get through that Albany roadblock, the nature of PFAS mean we'll be dealing with contamination for decades. What's the long-term outlook then?
Right. I mean, 100%. Even the bills that we're talking about are just chipping away at the problem. You know, the long-term outlook is that we have to also invest in safer solutions to the use of PFAS, right? So while it is important to get it out of our house and our kind of daily consumer products and personal care products as well, we have to start looking at safer alternatives, safer chemistries that industrial facilities can use, and we need to start figuring out ways to make that happen, because we can filter it out of the water all we want. We could require, you know, facilities to filter it out of their stacks and their pipes, but then we still have the problem of where do those filters go? How do we dispose of it? So ultimately, we need to turn off the tap to this chemical as much as possibly as we can, to allow for progress to happen kind of downstream. Mm-hmm.
That's Kate Donovan, Director of Northeast Environmental Health at Natural Resources Defense Council. Much more at nrdc.org. Kate, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you so much, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
I'm Jesse King. On this week's 51%, we chat with psychologist Dr. Samantha Sweeney about why teaching your kids to be culturally competent is important to their success as adults and how to do it.
Being in touch with your own biases as a parent is the first step. Please don't skip this. I say that multiple times throughout the book. Do not skip this first step.
This week on 51%.
Monday night at 8 on Radio Catskill.
In 1941, a young William F. Buckley watched Charles Lindbergh speak at an America First committee rally in New York.
The argument that came out of the right, which Buckley was involved with, was that the media was trying to censor and silence Lindbergh. Sound familiar?
William F. Buckley and the creation of modern American conservatism. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Monday, and that means it's time for our local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. Cue the music. Working 9 to 5, what a way. Hey, James B., how are you?
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Wow, lots to get to. Want to ask you about some economic data from last week, but first off, the news that's making headlines around the world. The strikes on Iran, how could those strikes affect the economy?
Well, probably remarkably little. All they're talking about is the possibility of an energy shock. It would be a worldwide thing if Iran were able to and chose to block the Strait of Hormuz. That would cut down oil going from Gulf countries to much of the world. We would be doing quite well in this country because we already generate enough oil to cover our needs. So in theory, we would not need any. So if that happens, and there is some concern whether Iran could actually do that, and of course, we may be preventing them from doing that if they can, that's the only thing I'm seeing as far as an effect on the worldwide economy. It could raise oil in some places, and it could end up raising it here if companies decide they can get more for it elsewhere and the world prices go up as a result. So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see in the next few days, really.
The Strait of Hormuz is that key shipping route for oil and gas. And according to CNBC this morning, the Dow is up as oil trades up into the red despite U.S. bombing of Iran. Let's talk a little bit more about that economic data, though, from last week. Interest rates last week. How did those change? What happened there?
They didn't.
Ah.
Once again, for the fourth straight time, the Federal Reserve left it unchanged. So it's now 4.25 to 4.5% for the federal funds rate. It's the same thing they did or didn't do in January, March, and May. Generally, they're saying what the Feds said was that things are remaining much the same. I have a statement here that uses the word remain or remains three times about labor market conditions and unemployment and inflation. So when everything is remaining, the interest rate should be remaining too. So this one wasn't close, really. It's much the same. It's not anywhere near to a situation where they would raise it or lower it. We'll see next time, and the next time will be July 29th and 30th.
And that's their next meeting coming up in July, so we'll keep an eye on that. Let's talk a little bit about, shifting gears a bit, to egg prices. What business are Americans going into more since egg prices went up, and what should they know about it?
More Americans are interested in considering and actually doing something to lay their own eggs. They're starting chicken coops. So some things that people may not know about them. That first, that chickens live a long time. Second, the chickens, after 2 or 3 years, can't lay eggs. Well, after they've had that, they're sort of worn out. It's hard on them, really, to do that. They're a big responsibility in general. Coops need to be kept clean. They need to be preventing any predators and such from coming in there. It's not easy, generally. It can be done, and a lot of people do it. You also have to make sure that it's legal to do it where you want to have a chicken coop. It's rural areas around here, certainly no problem, but there are places inside town or city limits where it may not be possible to do that. It may not be legal to do that. So consider it. But it is work. It's a real project. It's not a matter of just leaving them there and letting them lay eggs. There's more to it than that. Yeah, so
they don't show up just in a little egg carton in the chicken coop. There's a little work involved.
Right. There's quite a bit of work involved.
Let's talk about cars and new car prices. They've reached record numbers this year. Average monthly car payments also have increased, but you can reduce payments using something called the 20% rule. What's that?
It's simply putting 20% as a down payment before your loan amount is figured. That's what a lot of people are recommending. It will considerably reduce your payment amounts, and with that, the total amount you pay. If you can manage that, the article here recommends that you assess the vehicle's complete cost, including taxes and fees and interest. Funny the way interest works on car loans. Often you end up borrowing the interest instead of just paying the interest on the money. And so it's more. Figure out exactly what your payment would be and see if it fits within your budget. And then look at what the largest down payment you could make would do to cut that down. So it's making a big difference these days. The average car payment is 600 and some right now monthly. So if you're looking for something lower end or have a large down payment, you can make a larger down payment. It won't be that much, but they're getting pretty high these days.
We lost you there. Jim, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, somebody's dialing in there. Let's talk a little bit about AI. We talk about AI a lot, but here's something I've never heard. AI sludge and how it's impacting the job search. What's AI sludge?
Well, generally, it's garbage. It's poor quality text generated by AI. What we're getting now, it's in the big effect it has on job searching and job applications, is we're getting gigantic amounts of applications to ads because people are training or using AI to apply for them and modify their resumes and create their cover letters. So they're an example here of someone who put an ad out there for a remote position requiring 3 years of IT experience. They got, after 12 hours, this was on LinkedIn, they had 400 applications. Another 24 hours, there were 200 more. A few days later, there were 600 more than that, and they are figuring out who is a valid candidate worthy of pursuing. So if you're using AI, that's fine, but you may want to think twice before trying an automated or letting it do things without editing it. Now, there are people out there who have trained AI to look for and apply for jobs all by itself at very little time for the candidate. But it may not be good if you're just putting garbage out there, because a lot of it is getting rejected. So I recommend, certainly with any office use for AI now, that you proofread it and see what it's sending first, if the position really means anything to you. Again, if you're applying to vast numbers of them, it may be just worth your while to do it and hope, but I think the time when you were going to get anywhere with that may have passed.
Yeah, and I guess if you're using AI without editing or proofreading, then many of the resumes that folks are getting in the, you know, job office there look suspiciously similar. So it doesn't really make you stand out. Let's talk about the numbers. Let's talk about stock, oil, crypto, precious metal prices. Where were they this morning and how'd they change?
Okay, early this morning, gold was $33.65, up $49 down $49 rather for the previous week. It just seems maxed out where it is now. Silver $36.10, down 24 cents for a 93-1 silver to gold ratio. It's platinum and palladium have both been doing very well, even in the past week and such. Dow Jones Industrial Average, as of early this morning, it was 42,207 for plus 9. In other words, extremely close to being even. I'm looking at it now, and it's up 200, a little over 200 for the day so far. So it does like the news mentioned before. NASDAQ, 19,447, up 40 points for the week, also really very close to not doing anything. As of now, it's 19,563, or up 100 and some, also doing well, a similar percentage up from the Dow. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, we have 73.98 as of early this morning. I don't have a number for change so far today, but it only went up a dollar plus in the last week. So unless they actually block that straight, some analysts have been saying it's not going to go up anything significantly more. Bitcoin, 101,609 early this morning, down about 5,500. It turned back and gave up its gain from a couple of weeks ago. The British pound, 1.3388, down about 2 cents, and the euro, 1.1457, down 1.2 cents. Both of those make it look like the dollar has been strengthening some lately. Both of these were higher before, but they may have reached local peaks and coming down. And the Japanese 100 yen coin is at 68 cents, down a penny, just oscillating really between 68 cents and 70 cents. Overall, not much change this week, unless we're starting something with the U.S. and Iran taking it to a higher level. But late last week, it did go higher some of the time. The Dow was at 42.6 or 42.7 and such a lot of the week. So things have gone up and down in the past week, but the changes don't add up to a great deal right now.
All right, well, keep an eye on it. Thank you for keeping an eye on it. That is James B. Huntington, our local author and economist, with a local look at the economy, as he does every Monday. We'll see you next Monday, James B. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners. Use your mind.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's a look at the upcoming concert at the Cragsmore Stone Church in Cragsmore. Guitarist Harvey Valdez brings Bach and Satie to life in some unexpected ways. He'll be here along with Classical Kit right after a break. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Michael Inslecht once went on an unexpectedly grueling hike. It was awful, but he also remembers it fondly.
I felt like I'd learned something about myself. I'd learned that, like, okay, I'm resilient. You know, maybe I couldn't do Survivor, but maybe I'm not quite as weak as I thought I was.
Why humans do hard things, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dole. The White House asked Congress to take back $1 billion slated for public media, and they're about to do it. The House said yes, and now it's before the Senate, and time is running out for you to act. Please, tell your senators not to cut funding for programs you rely on in the Catskills and Northeast PA. Tell them what local news, culture, and emergency info mean to us all. Find out how at protectmypublicmedia.org. That's protectmypublicmedia.org.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And the summer concert series at the historic Cragsmore Stone Church launches this Saturday with a performance by acclaimed New York City-based guitarist and composer Harvey Valdez, known for his innovative interpretations of classical music. He'll present a unique program. Here to tell us more a little bit is Classical Kit and Mr. Valdez, but let's listen to a little bit of that music right now. Some of his work.
Yeah, good morning, Tim.
Good
this
morning.
Is just such a lovely thing to hear in the morning.
Tell us what we're listening to.
This is one of the pieces from the Bach Lute Suite that you can hear at Cragsmore this Saturday.
And Harvey Valdez is on the line with us as well. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Harvey, so nice to speak with you. I'm really looking forward to this concert. It's beautiful music, and it's also a really beautiful setting there, the Cragsmore Stone Church, which has one of the best views in the Catskills, I think, of the surrounding mountains. So you're a multi-instrumentalist, and you're going to be playing two of your instruments in this concert, among the many that you play. And we were just hearing a little bit of the Bach, and, you know, you've kept the rhythmic complexity of Bach, but you've added an extra layer of emotion, I think, in your performance. And I'm wondering if you could tell us what what brought you to play these works on the electric guitar.
Thank you. Yeah, Kit, I'm really excited to be performing for the church and playing some of the Bach Lute Suites for the performance this Saturday. And, I'm an electric guitarist first and foremost. I mean, that's the first instrument I picked up as a kid and still to this day. So it's always kind of been in the back of my mind, oh, it'd be great to interpret some works of Bach, particularly lute suites, because they lend themselves very well on the guitar in general. And it just, you know, it was one of these projects that I've always just kind of had in the back of my mind. And fortunately or unfortunately, the pandemic happened, right? And that gave me the time to really sink in and explore the works and really get them under my fingers and make a project to record them on electric guitar. And specifically the electric guitar, because it's not something that you would hear off at all, actually. I mean, normally you would hear these works played by classical guitarists on a classical guitar, nylon acoustic instrument. So being an electric guitarist, I thought it would be interesting to interpret them in a way that still honors the music in a way that's respectful to the music but and doesn't take anything away, but adds another kind of sonic layer to them, you know?
Yeah, and the album that you released in, I think, 2021 of these Bach works, I love the title Novare, which is, I believe, is Latin meaning to make new. And you've really done that. You've taken music that's very familiar, but you've created something new with it.
Thank you. Yes, that was definitely my goal.
And, you know, the other thing you're going to be playing in this concert, which really fascinates me, is Erik Satie's Ogives. And, you know, I mean, I've got lots of recordings of Erik Satie And mm-hmm. I don't think the Ogives are on any of them, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, so Ogive, I mean, I have an architecture background, so I knew what the word meant, that it was a Gothic pointed arch, but
right.
I didn't know that there was also a group of musical pieces. And right. One thing I've noticed about your playing, Harvey, you know, I've listened to your jazz, you know, your own compositions and other things is, like listening to your interpretation of the jazz standard Stella by Starlight.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like you play a note or a chord, and then it feels like you're pausing to listen to the instrument, giving the instrument all the time it needs to put out there what you put into it. And it's as if you're expanding the space in the music. Mm-hmm. And that spatial element, it really comes to the fore in your pedal steel guitar interpretation of the Ogives.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, yeah.
And so my understanding is that Satie was trying to evoke the sound of a pipe organ.
Right.
And so he does that with those big chords in when that's played on a piano. Mm-hmm. And it does seem kind of organ-like. But mm-hmm. when you play those pieces on pedal steel, it feels to me more like you're evoking the space.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And is that exactly. your intent, or was that in your mind?
Absolutely, because we don't know too much, but it seems that he was wanting to evoke the sound of a pipe, pipe organ in a cathedral, a very heavily reverberated cathedral. So that really stuck with me, being that the pedal steel on its own, it's a very dynamically, doesn't have too much range. And it's always in the back, kind of as a coloring role, and as we know it, mostly in country music. But it's a beautiful instrument with a lot of capabilities, and I thought, oh wow, this would be really, I can get into a space with this that I can create with some, the addition of guitar effects or effect pedals, a heavily reverberated space, which as the reverb for me. Also has another quality to it, another kind of musical quality, not just as an effect, although that can be, but as a way that it creates another voice, So as the harmonies are sustaining and the reverb kind of takes over a little bit, it starts to create another layer of kind of harmonies that start to bleed a little bit into something else, So the idea of creating a space for me was very important.
Yeah, and those layers of voices, made me think of Gregorian chants, which were kind
right.
of are for that acoustic space to get that effect. Mm-hmm. But you're yeah. able to do that without having to fly to Notre Dame,
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's really fun to play these pieces on the pedal steel. It gives it a whole nother character. As you know, the recordings I've heard of all piano players, and it's obviously wonderful. But yeah, bringing it into, again, kind of the idea with the Bach album as well. It's like bringing it forward to now. What would someone of now do with these pieces?
And could you just tell us a little bit about the other instruments that you play?
I play a variety of instruments. Yeah, mostly in the string instrument family, guitar-related family. I'm also an oudist, so I play oud, which is an Arabic lute, and it's a fretless. So for those out there in the audience that might not know what frets are, on a guitar, you typically just press your fingers on the notes that you need, and they're in tune. They're right there for you. And a fretless instrument, you don't have that. You'd have to have an approximation of the pitch. But specifically with Middle Eastern instrument, you have a lot of pitches that are in between. So, for example, on a piano, you have a white key and a black key. And for Arabic music or Middle Eastern music, you can be in between the white keys and the black keys. So, yes, that's an instrument that I play for a very long time. I played for the last 25 years now. Been involved a lot in these Middle Eastern music scene here in New York City. And on top of that, yeah, I play banjo, tenor banjo, mandolin, all kinds of different guitars of all kinds of, sonorities, 12-string, electrics, acoustics, different tunings, you know, so on and so on, and pedal steel, lap steel. So in a lot of my work, also I do a lot of theater work in Broadway, so having to play a lot of, I'm usually called a lot to play a lot of these different instruments, so that's, over the years, I built up this ability to jump around on all these instruments that I'm talking about here.
So that sound that we often hear in Arabic music with the oud, mm-hmm. where you're going between the notes and you're getting all mm-hmm. those tones and colors that are in between, mm-hmm. is that akin to what happens when you're playing pedal steel?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. There's a similar thing. I mean, there's visual lines on the instrument that would be an approximation as to the note being in pitch, as close to pitch. But, you know, there's always, you're playing the left hand is playing with a bar, and there's a lot of variation in the pitch with the bar. So, you know, there's a lot of vibrato to be used and kind of massaging the notes or the chords, the harmonies together to kind of, you know, find a harmonious sort of middle ground, you know. It's not a perfect instrument, you know. It's a machine that has knee levers and pedals on the floor, and they're all bending strings. So there's a lot of, a lot of pulling and pushing on the strings, which on a normal, like a guitar doing that will always usually pull it out of tune. But on the pedal steel, that's the nature of the instrument. So you're kind of always wrestling a little bit with the in-betweenness of pitches.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a really unique concert, and I'm hoping that you'll continue these explorations. Like, I'm wondering if at some point maybe you'll do some classical music on the oud. You know, I'm sure you do like Arabic classical music, but Western classical music on that instrument would be interesting as well.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
So this concert, it's this Saturday from 7 to 9. I think the doors open at 6. Nice to go early up to Cragsmoor because, as I said, it's just spectacular sight. And I believe you can get tickets through Eventbrite by either searching there for Harvey Valdez or for Cragsmoor. Is there anything else mm-hmm. that you'd like to tell us about that concert or anything else you have coming up?
Well, I'm really excited to be performing. I've not been to the Cragsmoor Church. Definitely been up in the Hudson Valley, all the region up there, but never to the church. So, and it's, as you were describing, it sounds really wonderful. And I've also heard a lot of people say similar things about the views up there. So I'm really excited. And I also hear that it sounds really beautiful inside too, very nice reverberant space. So I'm really just looking forward to playing these works for everyone there. And experiencing the space and creating an atmosphere for everyone, you know.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us this morning. I'm looking forward to the concert, and we're going to hear a little more from Novare.
We'll hear a little more
on
the way
up.
Harvey, thank you so much. Again, the Hilltop Experience presenting Harvey Valdez in a solo concert Saturday at the Cragsmoor Stone Church in Cragsmoor, New York. More information and advanced tickets at experiencethehilltop.com. And there's more about Harvey and his work at harveyvaldez.com. And we are going to listen to a little bit more on the way out. Classical Kit, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences. Creating a space for community celebration throughout the year. NACL.org. And from listeners like you.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Carter Sherman joins us to talk about her new book, The Second Coming, Sex and the Next Generation's Fight Over Its Future. She explores why Gen Z is having less sex, how the internet, politics, and miseducation are shaping intimacy, and what it all means for the future. Join us.
Listen to Fresh Air today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, one of the hottest days of the year so far today. Stay cool and well hydrated. It's 86 at our Liberty Studios, but the real feel index, 101. That hot weather is going to continue through Wednesday. There's a heat advisory in effect until 8 p.m. On Point is next.